Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. Hey guys, and welcome back to my channel for another video, where today I have an absolutely fascinating case for you. I remember hearing about this back when it first took place, as it happened not too far from me in England, but I never really thought to follow up on it. The last I knew, it was just a tragic accident. But whilst I was researching for new cases to cover, this happened to pop up again, and it was a complete rabbit hole to fall into. There are so many twists and turns in this story, a true old-fashioned murder mystery with some very intricate police work. Our story is about married couple Victoria and Emile Silliers. Victoria worked as a physiotherapist for the Ministry of Defence and met Emile, who was an instructor in the Royal Army Physical Training Corps, when she was treating him for a skiing injury. It didn't take long after meeting for Victoria to introduce Emile to her biggest passion, skydiving. They soon married, and by April 2015, when this story takes place, they'd been married for 4 years and lived in Amesbury with a 3-year-old daughter and a 5-week-old son. To the outside world, by 2015, the two seemed to have a pretty idyllic marriage. Up until the 5th of April 2015, when everything went wrong for 38-year-old Victoria. As well as being an army physiotherapist, Victoria was an avid skydiver. She was an Accelerate Freefall instructor with 2,654 jumps to her name. Skydiving was her biggest passion. She was fully trained in how to deal with inexperienced jumpers who went out of control in the air. She was able to change them round in the sky during freefall, catch them and get them in the right position mid-air. She had these hardcore skills. She was able to make sure that everyone else was always safe whilst they were falling. She was a member of the Army Parachute Association at the Theravon Airfield. When the 5th of April rolled around, it was her first jump for almost a year in Theravon, a big and exciting day for her. She'd had a baby only 6 weeks earlier, and as you can probably guess, you're not allowed to skydive whilst pregnant. That day, it was Easter Sunday, the weather was relatively poor and cloudy, and so Victoria and the 11 other jumpers that day decided to do what's referred to as a hop and pop, a low altitude jump at just 4,000 foot, where they would open their parachutes within seconds of getting out of the plane. The bad weather probably saved her life that day. She was the last of the 12 to make the jump. It didn't take long after she left the plane for people to notice something was going wrong for Victoria. When she released her main parachute, the lines became tangled, not acting as they should have done. But for any trained skydiver, this isn't an issue. There's always a reserve parachute for cases of emergency such as this. Only on this day, the reserve parachute also failed. Victoria went plummeting towards the earth, spiralling in the air as she did so. She didn't land in the airfield as she should have done, but in the freshly ploughed fields next door. Somehow Victoria survived. That softer ground cushioned her fall. There were so many small things that led to her miraculous survival that day. She shouldn't have survived. People watched from the ground as she fell towards the earth, powerless. There was nothing anyone could do to help. They immediately rushed towards her, expecting the worst, but were shocked to find her still alive, but obviously seriously injured. She broke her leg, collarbone, multiple ribs, and suffered spinal injuries, but survived. It was incredible that she hadn't died upon impact, and in fact, those who saw what happened were so sure they would find a dead body in that field that they even took a body bag with them. She's airlifted to nearby Southampton Hospital, where she begins her recovery. With Victoria safely in hospital, Mark Bayarda, the chief instructor and boss of the Army Parachute Association, takes a look at the parachute Victoria was wearing when she fell. Bayarda was one of the first people to reach her on the ground that day, and later said to the Guardian, "When we lifted her up onto the stretcher to put her in the helicopter, one of the paramedics asked if someone could look underneath to make sure no lines were still attached. That's the first time I looked at the equipment properly, and I could see the two ends of the risers on the reserve parachute were unattached. All the lines on one side of the parachute were also knotted up. There are these things called slinks on a parachute that connect the harness to the parachute, quite a vital part, but these were missing on the reserve. He begins a thorough look at the equipment. It was his job to see if it was defective or not as chief instructor. He had to figure out what had happened. He tried to find loose stitching on the harness or the canopy, any signs that the straps had been under pressure, just anything to suggest that the slings had been there and had come away. But there was nothing about the parachute that suggested there had been a technical fault. This particular reserve parachute had never been deployed before, but it had been inspected 16 different times by 16 different advanced packers over the course of its lifetime, most recently just 2 months earlier. Every single time it was checked, the slings were there as they should have been. It didn't make sense they would suddenly just not be there. The police weren't contacted immediately. It wasn't the protocol for a skydiving accident, and of course, everyone just assumed at first that it would have been an accident. Why wouldn't it have been? Again, according to The Guardian, there were 2.3 million jumps in the 10 years before Easter Sunday 2015. Out of those jumps, there were 2,900 cases where something went wrong and the reserve parachute had to be deployed. Not a single one of these times was there also a problem with the reserve, and each jumper landed safe. According to the British Parachute Association, there's only one known case of both the main and reserve parachute failing to operate, and the man, Stephen Hilder, felt his death. Even then, it was found that the risers on his reserve had been cut, and whilst it was initially a murder investigation, it was found that it was probably a suicide. The only DNA found on the kit was his, and the scissors used to make the cuts were found in the back of his car. Many still believe that Stephen was actually murdered, but that's a story for another time. The point I'm trying to make here is skydiving accidents don't really happen. When the police were contacted, they sent somebody to question Victoria in the hospital about the accident. The parachute was also collected officially by the British Parachute Association, who were also required to conduct their own investigation into the fall as per their protocol. The police expected everything to come back as a mechanical failure, a tragic accident, and that would be that, the case could be closed. Only that isn't what happened. Like Bayada, the BPA also couldn't find any mechanical reason as to why the parachute failed. Had the slings just happened to fall off the parachute midair as well, you'd expect to find them somewhere on the airfield or surrounding fields, but they were nowhere to be seen. It became very clear that this accident wasn't an accident at all. It was a premeditated attack, an attempted murder. It was pure luck that Victoria had survived. The police begin their investigation by looking into Victoria's life. Did she have anyone in her life who would want to harm her? Did she have any enemies? Was this parachute specifically meant for Victoria, or did somebody mess with the parachute with no particular target in mind, wanting just anyone to be hurt? Or was the intended target somebody else entirely? The investigation was led by Detective Inspector Paul Franklin. Franklin says that a few days into the investigation, he got a call from a friend of Victoria's, who said that there were issues with the relationship between her and her husband. From the outside, Victoria and Emile's marriage looked idyllic, the perfect nuclear family with their two children. But all was not as it seemed. There were problems behind the scenes, domestic abuse issues, but not of the physical kind, more mental coercion. This immediately raised questions about Emile in relation to the investigation. But was this really enough to suggest that he would attempt to kill his wife? All couples have their problems, all couples argue. There wasn't evidence of attempted murder. Emile Silliers was every bit the army man, the responsible husband who provided for his family. He was originally from South Africa, having arrived in the UK in 2011. In South Africa, he had a long-term girlfriend called Nicolene Shepherd, with whom he had two children, the first born shortly after Nicolene's 16th birthday. Emile's daughter has since said that he was always a very attentive father. That is, up until the point that he upped and left for a new life in the UK. Nicolene said that the two were engaged, but they never made up the aisle as Emile was cheating on her. In the late 90s, Emile came to the UK on a working holiday visa and worked in pubs and bars. As far as Nicolene was aware, the two were still in a relationship and Emile would return home often. He visited home at the end of 2000 and the relationship continued as normal. He didn't say anything to suggest there was a problem between the two. However, Nicolene was shocked to find out that not long after he returned back to the UK, he married a woman called Carly Taylor, completely out of the blue, or so it seemed to her. Eventually, Nicolene moved to the UK herself, completely unrelated to her ex-boyfriend. And years later, her daughter asked if she could get to know her father. Upon contacting Emile, the spark was very much still alive between Nicolene and Emile, and Emile claimed that him and Carly were getting a divorce. This was not true. Emile at this point had four children, two with Nicolene and two with Carly. Eventually, the relationship with both women comes to an end. Emile then meets Victoria, the two marry, and they go on to have two more children together. So with this new information about Victoria and Emile not having this perfect marriage, Franklin was unsure of what steps to take next. Emile was the obvious suspect to be looking at here. Up to 50% of women killed in the UK are killed by their husbands. But still, there was no proof. They had to have proof that Emile was the kind of person who would do something like this. And then the police find out something very interesting. They find out that the day before, Emile had been the one to check out Victoria's parachute, and he disappeared with the parachute into the toilet for 5 to 10 minutes. That was opportunity, and the police felt they had no choice but to arrest and question him at this time. On the 28th of April 2015, Emile Silliers was arrested at his barracks in Aldershot on suspicion of attempted murder. He made no objection, he had very little reaction at all, and he did not want a solicitor no matter how many times he was asked. That night he was interrogated for 6 hours and never once cracked under the pressure. He was deadpan. He calmly admitted to the police that he wanted to leave Victoria, that he wasn't happy in the marriage. He admitted to having another girlfriend, an Austrian woman he met on Tinder 4 months earlier whilst abroad on a skiing trip with the army. She was called Stephanie Goller and they'd been in contact ever since. He had plans to move abroad with her. He admitted all of this to the police, probably not just for the sake of full clarity, but because he probably knew the police would find out anyway. Better to admit it and get out ahead of it, I suppose. And whilst all of this did paint him as a shitty husband, it still wasn't enough proof that he was a murderer. They had nothing to suggest that he'd done anything wrong. So they have no choice but to let him out on bail on the conditions that he was not allowed to go home, he was not allowed to have any contact with Victoria or the children. Whilst Emile was being arrested and questioned, the police were informing Victoria, who'd been released from hospital on the 22nd of April, just 1 week after the fall. The police were telling her of their suspicion of Emile's involvement. Now, you'd probably expect her to be upset, to be confused, but her reaction surprised the police. When they told her that Emile would not be allowed back to the family home for her own safety, she was devastated. She was a woman in a back brace, in a lot of pain, with two young children, one practically still newborn, and she had to look after them. She needed her husband at home with her and couldn't seem to fathom the possibility that he could have attempted to murder her. She was completely in denial, and seeing as the police had no physical evidence of his involvement at this point, there was little they could do to convince her. The police were basically acting at this point on the tip-off from Victoria's friend and the fact that Emile had been the one to take out Victoria's parachute. So whilst Emile is freed on bail and Victoria is recovering from her ordeal, investigators begin the painstaking job of trawling through Emile's technological footprint. They begin with his phone, where they were already expecting to find contact with another woman, as he admitted in his interview. But on his phone, they find over 30,000 texts to Stephanie Goller in just 4 months. They were in constant contact all the time. Emile told Stephanie that he wasn't his newborn baby's father, that Victoria had cheated on him, and that their marriage was essentially over. He even said that there was a DNA test that proved that he wasn't the father of his newborn son. All lies and quite callous. But it turns out that it wasn't only his new lover that Emile was messaging in this time. He was also still sleeping with his ex-wife Carly, who lived just 2 miles away, and was also a member of a website called Fab Swingers, where he hooked up with partners regularly for casual sex, as well as regularly contacting sex workers on a site called Adult Work. This was not a faithful man, he was living multiple different lives at the same time. D.I. Franklin made a very difficult choice to tell Victoria of her husband's infidelities in the hope that it would get her on side. It was concerning to police that she was still so willing to be with the man who the authorities were so sure had tried to murder her. And as you can probably guess, Victoria was devastated by the news, not sure how to process it. I suppose it's easier to believe your husband's having an affair than it is to believe that he tried to kill you. It's only at this point that Victoria turns around and says that she supposes she should probably tell the police about a gas leak that had happened in her house just 6 days before the fall. On the Sunday night before, Emile had gone to stay at his barracks in Aldershot. A few months earlier, him and Victoria had come to an agreement where he would stay at the barracks throughout the week whilst he was working to apparently save on the long drive between there and Amesbury twice a day. It seemed like the logical thing to do. But in reality, it just gave Emile more freedom for his cheating escapades. The Sunday night was just like any other. He helped put the kids to bed and he said goodbye to Victoria before heading off. The next morning, Victoria woke to the smell of gas in the house and she went downstairs, opening all the windows as she did so. She texted her husband about it, who very strangely replied, "Have you turned the stove on?" I mean, obviously she hadn't, as it would likely have killed her and both the children instantly. A very strange question to ask given the circumstances. It's not, "Don't turn the stove on," it was, "Have you turned the stove on?" An emergency gas engineer is called out, who found the issue was simply a nut on the gas pipe leading to the hob was loose. He simply tightens it, quarter of a turn, and the problem was solved. No more gas leak. And then the failed parachute jump happened just 6 days later. In fact, it was that very same day after the gas issue had been fixed that Emil suggested they go skydiving the next weekend as a celebration of Victoria having given birth. When Victoria told investigators about the gas leak, they were of course immediately suspicious. For a woman to have two brushes with death in 1 week and survive is A, a miracle, but B, potentially proof that someone, potentially a husband, is trying to mess with her. Only the issue is that all the evidence investigators had was purely circumstantial at this point. They had nothing physical. And it's very hard to convince a jury on circumstantial evidence. They knew there was no way to get a conviction on the little evidence they had. Emil was clearly a very shitty husband, but that does not equal a murderer. The investigators collect the gas pipe as evidence and send it away for forensic testing. And it doesn't take long for the forensic team to find blood on the pipe, which is later proven to belong to Emil, but this was easily explained away. A man doing DIY in his own house and injuring himself isn't exactly a rare occurrence. But microscopic analysis of the nut revealed that some kind of grip had left marks on it, proving that it hadn't become loose by some kind of accident. It wasn't a mechanical issue. Somebody had purposefully loosened this nut. And it just so happened that the tool that had loosened the nut was found in with Emil's very own tools. Emil explained to the police that he tried to tighten the nut before, a while ago, but the forensic analysis proved that the grip had not been used to ever tighten the nut, only ever loosen it. I think it's incredible the things they can prove through forensics these days. I have no idea how they'd be able to prove something like that, but apparently they can. Emil insisted that if that was the case, he must have accidentally turned it the wrong way, but he also insisted that no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get the nut to move. His story was falling apart. So now the police had evidence that he'd meddled with the gas pipe, but they still couldn't prove that he had anything to do with the parachutes being faulty. Emil and Victoria had originally gone with their kids to the airfield to do the jump on the Saturday. Whilst Victoria was filling in forms at the main desk, Emil went to check them out their parachute kits. Victoria's usual rig, the technical proper name for the parachute, was away being serviced at this time, so she was going to hire a rig from the APA. It's at this point that the police think that Emil purposefully sabotaged Victoria's chute. He told the police he had to take the children to the toilets at one point, and so went in there with the parachutes out of sight. He was in the toilets for between 5 to 10 minutes with the parachutes, and according to the BBC, Victoria had told the police, "It struck me as a little bit odd. Normally you just put your rig down somewhere, you wouldn't take it with you." But there were low clouds that day, and seeing as skydiving is an incredibly weather-dependent sport, they couldn't jump on the Saturday, deciding to jump the next day, Sunday, instead. Only this would have potentially ruined Emil's plans. If he put the parachutes back with the rest, there was no guarantee that Victoria would be the next person to get that parachute, and any random person could be the one to fall to their death. Emil convinced Victoria they should store the kits in their lockers overnight instead to save the faff for the next day, he said. It was against regular protocol, but Victoria agreed, not wanting the aggro of an argument. So the next day, they simply turn up at the airfield, grab their respective parachutes out of their locker, and off they go. The investigators decided to task two parachute riggers from different areas of the country with the task of tampering with a main and reserve parachute in under 5 minutes, asking them to do so within the restriction of a toilet cubicle. It was proven that it was possible for both men to do so, and Emil had matching skill levels to these men. He was also a very experienced skydiver, and in November 2010 he'd obtained a main parachute pattern certificate, gaining detailed knowledge of the workings of such parachutes. This certificate enabled him to earn some extra money as a parachute packer. In October 2012, he'd completed a reserve parachute packing course as well. So essentially, he knew exactly how to pack and potentially meddle with a parachute. But the police still needed more evidence. In her original conversation with the police, Victoria had told officers her husband wasn't exactly great with money. He was in debt to a lot of people, he defaulted on loans and took money from a savings account, then denied doing so. But investigators found that Emil had debts of over £22,000, and he constantly moved money around between his accounts to hide the extent of his debts. Victoria told the police that at one point he'd arranged an overdraft and a loan on a joint account without her knowledge and claimed his bank account had been hacked. His text to his Austrian girlfriend showed that he was intending to start a new life abroad. He'd promised her all kinds of luxury goods and holidays, but he simply didn't have the money to live up to any of these promises. What he did have, though, was PAX insurance, a special type of insurance for members of the British Armed Forces. Obviously, as a member of the army, you generally need more than just a standard insurance policy. PAX can be increased if you're fighting abroad, generally in more danger, and then lowered again once you're back home and safer. Investigation showed that despite Emil having six children, he generally kept his insurance on the lower side. However, shortly before the events with Victoria, he changed his life insurance, which covered the both of them, to £120,000. Was he planning to collect this after Victoria's death, or was it just yet another coincidence? Police were able to prove by this point that Emil had the opportunity, motive, and ability to attempt to kill his wife. Only they had another issue to contend with now. Victoria had pulled away from the investigation. Bar that one conversation where she first casted suspicion on her husband, she's now denying her husband had anything to do with the events. She was definitely more on the side of Emil than the police, and she later said in court that she'd expanded on the truth when originally speaking to the police. She'd just found out the husband had been cheating on her with multiple women. She said that, at that point, I wanted him to suffer. I wanted to cast suspicion and wanted revenge for the affair. She said she wanted to paint him in a bad light, and the police ran with it. It took 2.5 years to finally get a case strong enough to go to trial. It took months for the small team to extract and go through all of the data from Emil's phone, and another while for the Crown Prosecution Service to review the investigation and decide that the case was strong enough for a realistic chance of conviction. The trial began on the 11th of October 2017, with Emil, of course, denying all charges. Two counts of attempted murder and one of damaging a gas valve, recklessly endangering a life. The trial did not go as investigators expected it to, though. The fact that Victoria seemed to be working against them, saying that she'd expanded on the truth and overall seemed to defend her husband on the stand, didn't look particularly great. It's hard to get a conviction when the victim doesn't seem to think they're a victim. Emil suggested in court that a stranger may have been the one to tamper with the parachute and said explicitly that he had not tampered with the gas pipe. The trial had its fair share of drama. About a month into it, the judge, Mr. Justice Sweeney, had to discharge four women and another female juror after they came down with stress-related illnesses, forcing the jury down from 12 to 10. As a result of this, the judge told the jurors that their deliberations must remain within the proper bounds of a discussion and not amount to improper pressure or bullying. Basically, the judge told off the jury for apparently bullying one of the other jurors. As a response, the remaining 10 jurors had to produce a note in which they said, "Following yesterday's further direction, the jury returned to the deliberation room to read and discuss the direction as discussed. The jury unanimously agreed that no such bullying had taken place. We then proceeded to further deliberation in the time remaining." Of course, all of this apparent bullying all came out in the press, with people seemingly focusing more on that than the actual trial at hand. It was just a bit of a shambles. The trial continued, but at conclusion, the jury deliberated for 30 hours, returning to say that a verdict simply could not be reached. There was going to have to be a retrial. Mr. Justice Sweeney thanked them for their hard work and discharged the jury. Emil was freed on conditional bail until a date for the retrial could be fixed. Said retrial finally began in April the following year, 11th of April 2018, almost 3 years to the date of the parachute fall. In the first trial, the police had left out many details about Emil's sex escapades and the true extent of his cheating, mainly to save embarrassment for Victoria. They thought the evidence would be enough without that detail, but clearly it wasn't. If they wanted Emil to be convicted at this retrial, then no stone could be left unturned. Emil's defence had presented him as some kind of pantomime villain in the first trial. Not a great man or great husband, but ultimately harmless, and the prosecution had to rebuff this picture of him completely if they wanted to win. In the second trial, the jury heard evidence of Emil's affairs, including the contact with sex workers and swingers online. And just because I know that somebody will jump down my throat if I don't clarify, it's not inherently a bad thing to use sex workers or be involved in swingers clubs. You do you. But in this context, it painted a portrait of Emile as being an untrustworthy man. He wasn't this typical nuclear family man that he seemed portrayed. He was constantly cheating on Victoria with his ex-wife, his new girlfriend, and numerous sex workers. He would hold multiple different conversations with his lovers, sexting with one whilst messaging Victoria about plans with the kids and what's for dinner. This is a man living multiple different lives. On the 13th of March 2015, he arranged to meet his ex-wife for sex before arranging to have unprotected sex with a sex worker for £100 and asking her to film it, and then going back home to Victoria. This new approach for the prosecution worked, and on the 24th of May 2018, he was found guilty on all counts. His sentencing took place on the 15th of June, with Mr. Justice Sweeney saying that he believed the offences were planned and carried out in cold blood. The prosecution named his three motives as 1, him having major money problems that he believed would be solved by his wife's death because he would receive a huge payout from the insurance. 2, her murder would prevent her from damaging his career, which he'd showed his concerns about through his emails. And 3, he'd met and was passionately in love with Stephanie Goller, with whom he had pledged his future, and he wanted his wife dead to enable him to have this unobstructed relationship with his new love. The judge said in his sentencing statement that the fact that Emile sabotaged the parachutes in the toilet whilst in the presence of his young daughter spoke volumes about the sort of person he was and the gravity of his offending. Whilst Victoria was in hospital in theatre, Emile was still texting his girlfriend, telling these complex lies to keep this relationship going. He never showed even the slightest sign of remorse, and the judge agreed with the prosecution that Emile had shown himself to be a person of quite exceptional callousness who would stop at nothing to gratify his own desires. The judge said that for these three reasons and more, a life sentence was justified in this case, as it was wicked offending of extreme gravity. On counts 1 and 3, the sentence was one of life imprisonment with a minimum term of 18 years. On count 2, the sentence was 14 years imprisonment, with all sentences to run concurrently. Victoria struggled to accept that her husband would be guilty of such a thing. She said to the press, "Yes, I'm hurt and angry, but can I see him as capable of murder? No. I'm going to grieve for the marriage I had and the end of the life that I had. I'll always care for the father for my children and I loved him. I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life with him. I have to go with, I suppose, the verdict. It's too big to get my head around. It's hard to comprehend that someone you get married to and have children with would be capable of that. I really feel for Victoria. She was clearly in an emotionally manipulative marriage. She never truly knew the man that she was married to, who was so talented at living so many different lives consecutively. I can't imagine the pain of finding out that your husband attempted to kill you, not once, but twice. Trying to tie that person to the person you thought you married. I really hope she's doing okay now, and it seems like she's actually releasing a book entitled I Survived, which is being released on the 6th of August 2020. The tagline reads, "I married a charming man, then he tried to kill me. A true story." Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.